Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the hand upon the lives of men like David in history that you arranged and you ordered and you led and guided and directed in such a way that their lives still speak to us today. I pray that you would please speak to each one of our hearts according to what we need to hear from you this morning from David's life. And we thank you in the name of the Lord Jesus. Amen. All right. 1 Samuel chapter 18. We're continuing in our study through the life of David. We'll be picking up in verse 12 where we left off. The circumstances are we're still right after the time in which David has won the great victory over Goliath. And following that victory, David's been rewarded with extra blessings in his life circumstances of being given a responsibility over a portion of the king's army. He's now a military leader in the army. And what we focused on last week is that this is one more evidence of how the Lord intends to work in each one of our lives spiritually, which is that as we grow in the Lord, we always will be growing in responsibility. It's kind of the reverse of the way the world looks at things. The world looks at things as we grow in responsibility only in order to be able to increase our earning power up to a certain point in our lives. And then when we've earned enough money, the goal in the eyes of the world is, I want to start relinquishing responsibility as quickly and as rapidly as I possibly can so that I can get to the point in my life where I have all of the blessings of responsibility that you know, the money, the income that came from that, but now I don't have any more actual responsibility, so I can just put my life on cruise control and relax from that point forward. That's, of course, not the way of the Lord. The way of the Lord is, as we grow in Him, as our lives progress in Him, He wants us to take on greater and greater responsibility. He causes us to grow in Him because we're growing into His image. Of course, the Lord doesn't relinquish any of His responsibilities from the first day of creation until today. The Lord is still in charge of all things, and He doesn't want us to follow the model of the world. He wants us to follow His model and become more and more like Him. And so, on top of that, let's read from 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 12, as we go on in David's story. Now, Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but he had departed from Saul. Therefore, Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as his commander of 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, and he went out and came in before them. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "My hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him." But David said to Saul, "Who am I, and what is my life or my father's family in Israel, that I should be the king's son-in-law?" So it came about at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. When they told Saul, the thing was agreeable to him. Saul thought, "I will give her to him that she may become a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore Saul said to David, "For a second time you may be my son-in-law today." Then Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David secretly, saying, 'Behold, the king delights in you, and all his servants love you. Now therefore become the king's son-in-law.'" So Saul's servants spoke these words to David, but David said, "Is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and lightly esteemed?" The servants of Saul reported to him according to these words which David spoke. And Saul then said, Thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry except 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. Now Saul planned to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. When his servants told David these words, it pleased David to become the king's son-in-law. Before the days had expired, David rose up and went, he and his men, and struck down 200 men among the Philistines. Then David brought their foreskins, and they gave them in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. So Saul gave Michal his daughter for a wife. When Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened, as often as they went out, that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul. So his name was highly esteemed. All right, there's some continuing developments in David's life story here as the Lord is working in David's circumstances, not just in David's heart, but working in the pattern of the circumstances that are developing around him. And one of the things I think we need to really draw from this and understand from this is that as we grow and progress in our own relationship with the Lord, we count on and expect, we hope for and trust that the Lord is continually working in our hearts, that he's continually at work to cause us to grow and to grow in our relationship with him. But one of the biggest factors in David's story, in David's life, in David fulfilling his purpose, what the Lord had appointed for him, was that the Lord was not just at work in David's heart, internally, hidden in secret from the eyes of the world, but the Lord was at work constantly in David's circumstances. What we see here is the hand of the Lord at work all around David, not just within David. And there are times when believers tend to lose track of the greater purpose of God in their circumstances and begin to see their circumstances as kind of an enemy to what the Lord is trying to accomplish in their lives, rather than seeing the circumstances as serving God's purpose in their life. Each one of us here, out of all these men here this morning, we're all, each one of us, in a different set of life circumstances. Some of them are pleasant and preferable, and some of them are difficult and challenging and what we would not necessarily have chosen for ourselves. I'm thinking of like our brother David, who's hosting us this morning, you know, recently got news, unexpected, unchosen, not desired news, that his career was going to take a sudden and unexpected turn, in that his job was being downsized, and he was going to be, you know, so to speak, in the eyes of the world, a victim of a reorganization. And, you know, any one of us, if we get news, you know, next month, you're not going to have a job any longer, and you're going to have to figure out some other way to make a living. That's not good news. You know, that's not the kind of news that we would say, oh, gosh, I can't wait for the Lord to do that in my life. You know, that's one of the things that we all kind of like, I hope that never happens to me. Yet, the spiritual reality is, and, you know, David understands this, and that's why he's not here shaking in his socks this morning. He is aware, as David had already begun to learn, that the Lord is as powerfully at work around us as he is within us. So David is experiencing the hand of the Lord at work in his heart while he's in this set of unexpected circumstances, but he also trusts and believes before he sees the end of the circumstance play out that the Lord's at work in his circumstances. He's at work in the world around him and is structuring, designing, shaping, and molding circumstances to serve some greater hidden purpose that he can't fully see. He doesn't necessarily even fully understand on this side of the situation, but as he passes through it, believes that the Lord is at work out here, the Lord is at work in here, and it's all dovetailing to accomplish God's will for my life. So let's look at some of the Lord's hand in David's circumstances. First is there's this ongoing issue with Saul. And this is something, you know, we're going to be in David's life for a while on into the future months. And we're going to just keep coming back to the same issue. There's a problem of an ongoing relationship that David can't fully escape. He's not yet meant to fully escape it. As long as Saul is alive, the Lord has designed for David and Saul to be connected, for David to be close to Saul, and yet it's not a pleasurable, preferable kind of relationship. There's a problem in the relationship. And you know how it is. We talk about situations where we get involved in a bad relationship, and the world looks at that and says, you know, in any bad relationship between people, there's always blame to be shared. There's always blame to be spread around. If there's two people that are having a problem, there's always problems on both sides of that relationship. That's how the world tends to look at it. Is that necessarily true? The answer is absolutely not. It can be that there's blame on both sides, but in this circumstance, where is the actual spiritual blame for the deterioration of the relationship between Saul and David? It's on Saul's end 100%. That doesn't mean that David is perfect. Doesn't mean that the Lord isn't still working on certain issues in David's life. And as David's life continues, we're going to see that the Lord spotlights and highlights certain areas in David's life that still need to be changed, still need to be conformed to the character of Christ. But at this point, it's very clear. We're meant to see it exactly from this perspective, that the spiritual problems are in Saul's heart, not in David's heart. David has, up till now, only served Saul, been faithful to Saul, honored Saul, obeyed Saul, done everything that the Lord has required of him in relationship to Saul. And what is the thanks that David gets back from Saul? I hate you. I want you dead. All right? And so what is David's response to that? You know, is David supposed to disengage and leave and get as far away, get as much distance from Saul as he can possibly get? Well, the Lord has a purpose in him being in this relationship. And so what we see from that is that the Lord has designed the relationship for David's blessing, but not in a direct way. There are some relationships in our lives that are just good and rich, like we saw in a recent study that we went through. David has a different kind of relationship with another member of Saul's household, his son Jonathan. That's a relationship of pure blessing in David's life. Jonathan loves David as much as David loves Jonathan. Jonathan is as faithful to David as David is faithful to Jonathan. But the relationship with Saul is of an entirely different category, different type entirely. And this is a relationship that is meant to be a blessing in David's life, but not in a direct way. What he is getting directly from Saul is what we would call a curse. He's getting Saul's hatred. He's getting Saul's fear. He's getting Saul scheming against his very life, and certainly against his success in the world. Because Saul, and why is it again, you know, just so we're all tracking together, why is it that Saul has these strong adverse feelings toward David that he's operating under? What is it about David that bothers Saul so much? Because all David's done is served him as an armor bearer faithfully. All he's done is take care of the biggest problem that Saul was facing at the time, which is the challenge of Goliath and winning a victory for King Saul. Why is it that Saul is so upset with David to the point that he wants to literally have him killed? Jealousy and fear. The fear going along with jealousy that David is going to take his place. He's afraid that he's going to lose his position to this young man of God that is clearly under the hand of the Lord's blessing. Saul knows that the hand of the Lord has been removed from him, that he is operating now in his own strength, in his own abilities, smarts to stay on top of his life circumstance. He's no longer experiencing or living out his role as king under the hand of the Lord's blessing. But David clearly is. And Saul recognizes that in David. And so David becomes this ongoing threat in Saul's perspective. So the first thing he does in verses 12 and 13 is Saul figures out a way to keep David close enough to have influence over him, but far enough away that he doesn't have to be troubled by his continuing immediate presence. Because David's presence is a reminder to Saul. He's a reminder of earlier days when he was himself in a better relationship, in a better place with the Lord. And that's too painful for him to be reminded of that. So he appoints David as a commander over a portion of his army to get some distance between himself and David. But the problem is, of course, that his idea of appointing David to be a commander and to get some distance from him backfires on Saul. And why does it backfire? Because the Lord blesses David wherever he goes. Whatever he does, whatever he's assigned, whatever he's given, the Lord works in David's circumstances and causes him to prosper in that situation. It's kind of an echo of a passage. You don't have to turn there. Let me just read this to you from, this is from the beginning of the book of Joshua. And this is certainly true of David's life, as we'll see later as David writes about this. But this is from the Lord's encouraging words to Joshua as the Lord spoke to him when there was the great transition between the death of Moses and Joshua being appointed as leader over the people. And he says to him this, "Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous. Then you will have success." The promise of the Lord to his people is that if you stay close to me, you pay attention to what I have revealed to you in my word, and you will simply follow that and obey that, I will ensure that whichever way you go, whichever way I lead you in your life circumstances, you'll be blessed in that situation. I'll watch over you to make sure that you're blessed. That's what's going on with David. And of course, Saul formerly had experienced that, but was now missing that blessing from the Lord. And so back to 1 Samuel 18, in verse 14, David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. It's not just that David was prospering, it's that Saul was observing it, watching the hand of the Lord's blessing in David's life. And you know, when you're in a good place, and the Lord blesses, you're in a good place with the Lord, and the Lord blesses someone next to you, what's your response and reaction to the Lord's blessing in their life? Yeah, I'm so glad. I'm so, blessed to see how the Lord is blessing you. But when you're not in a good place with the Lord and you're missing the blessings of the Lord in your life and you see the Lord blessing someone else, especially someone that you don't feel particularly close to and or good about, then it creates within us that feeling of jealousy and that feeling of envy that they're receiving something that I think I deserve that I'm not receiving from the Lord myself. And so Saul was stirred up at an even greater level against David simply for no greater reason than the Lord was blessing David, and Saul hated him for it. Now from there, Saul hatches a plot. He has a plan that occurs to David. Verse 17, "Then Saul said to David, 'Here is my older daughter, Merib. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be a valiant man for me and fight the Lord's battles.' For Saul thought, 'My hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him.'" All right, well, first of all, what's the problem with Saul's offer in verse 17? Saul approaches David and he says to him, "I've got a great idea. Why don't you become my son-in-law? And I only have, one requirement. I need you to agree to continue to pursue your military career on my behalf, and not just on my behalf, but on behalf of the Lord. These are really the Lord's battles. And if you will do that, I will cement our relationship by making you my son-in-law, by giving my daughter, my eldest daughter, Mirab, to you as your wife. What's the problem that's going on here? Yeah, this is not like some special offer that is really a blessing to David. This is simply Saul reneging on an earlier promise that he had made to David. Let's look back to chapter 17 for a moment, the recent history of the story. Right before David went into battle against the Philistine giant Goliath, let's read in verse 25. The men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who is coming up?" That's Goliath that they're referring to. And they're describing this to David. "Surely he is coming up to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." Now, these are the men of Israel, the men in the army of Israel that are rehearsing this to David. Remember, David came onto the scene of the battle with Goliath. He came onto the scene from his father's flocks. He had not heard anything that was going on in the battle zone. He came into this situation. He hears Goliath defying the armies of Israel, and he basically asks, "What's going on? Who is this guy? And how come this challenge isn't being answered?" And the army in unison fills David in and informs him of what was common knowledge among them. Now, do you think that the army was just making this stuff up? Like, hey, you know, if you go out and kill this guy, you know, we promise you this is what the king will do for you. They're not making this up at all. They have this information because the king, Saul, has previously promised this to anyone in the army that will take care of this problem and kill Goliath for him. So no doubt, even though we don't have the actual scene, prior to this verse, the king has made an announcement to his army. And he's promised wealth, freedom from taxes for the rest of your family's life, and the hand of my eldest daughter in marriage, if you'll but go out and take care of this problem, Goliath, for me. Now, David steps up, and he doesn't step up for those three reasons. He steps up for higher spiritual purposes, and he meets the challenge of Goliath and kills Goliath. But at the moment David kills Goliath, he is righteously owed by the king as a debt to be enriched by the king, to be have his family free from taxes for the rest of their lives, and the king's eldest daughter's hand in marriage. He is owed that as a debt by Saul. So when we get over back into chapter 18 now, and Saul comes to David and says, "Here is my older daughter Mirab. I will give her to you as a wife. Only I want you to do something additional for me." What he's now doing is an unrighteous thing. He's basically saying, "Look, I'll give you what I previously promised, but you've got to do this additional thing for me." It's like adding to a contract after the ink is already dried and after the contract has already been signed. Now, the Lord sees that. The Lord knows that. And in spite of Saul's scheme, in spite of his plan, the Lord has a different plan here. But what is Saul's scheme? Why is it that he's really offering his daughter to David at this point? What is it? You know, we saw from the earlier offer, he, you know, in Saul's perspective, his daughter is just a bargaining chip to motivate the hearts of his army to go out and fight against Goliath. Now he's using his daughter as a bargaining chip in an additional way. And the goal is to get David, as it says here, to fight for me and to fight the Lord's battles. But as he's saying this, and of course it sounds, as he's saying it, somewhat noble, because he's the king, to fight for the king, and not just the king, but he brings in the name of the Lord. Saul mentions, "What I'm wanting you to do is go out and fight the Lord's battles." He's added a religious element to this circumstance to make it appear in the eyes of David and in the eyes of the community that this is a very good and spiritual thing that he's asking of David. But what's his real heart's motive as he's making this additional offer of his daughter's hand? Yeah, he's really looking for a way to eliminate David still. The idea of having the hand of the Philistines be against him is, and it's interesting when he says, my hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. Remember in our study last time that in his fits of rage against David, there were those two times that Saul took up his own spear and attempted to pin David to the wall with the spear. Now, if that's not a man's hand being against another man, you know, what is? He attempted to kill him with his own hand. So when Saul says, "My hand shall not be against him," there's no honor or nobility in what he's saying. He's not saying, "I would not dare to attack David myself." What he's basically saying is, "I've tried to attack him twice, and I failed each time because the Lord keeps protecting him from me, and so I've got to find a better way to kill this guy. If I can't kill him myself, maybe I can get the Philistines to kill him." And so he cooks up this idea of attaching the promise of his daughter to the battling with the Philistines. Now, how does David respond to this? David says to Saul, "Who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law?" David is reluctant to accept the offer. Now, I think there's probably a good practical reason here at the beginning. His initial reluctance may have something to do with the fact that Saul's tried to kill him previously two times. And, you know, that's probably pretty fresh in his mind. But there's something more than just natural reluctance going on here. We see a real element of true spiritual humility in David's heart. He's saying, "Who am I? And, you know, do I really rate? What is it about my family that the king would choose to include my family into his?" Which is what would happen in a covenant marriage, that David's family would forever be honored by being associated or aligned with the king's family in that way. And so David, in humility, defers. And, of course, that isn't an ultimate barrier to Saul, because Saul really is after David here. But it's an interesting response that comes about in verse 19. Even though David is giving an initial reluctant response, the idea is that the plans for marriage have been set in motion. And in verse 19, "So it came about at the time when Merib should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel for a wife instead." Now, we don't know the backstory here. We're not given the details of what has changed in the interim. But Saul's made a promise, and at some point between the promise that's made and the day that was set for the wedding, Saul changes his mind. And he gives his eldest daughter to this other man, probably some man in his army, or in his court. We don't know for sure the details of Adriel's story. But he gives him to this other man instead. Now, why would Saul, when he's already hatched a plot to do this, why would he change his mind like this? Why would there be this sudden and unexpected twist in the story? What's going on here? And we're not given any surface-level information that explains why the change in plans. But we need to understand, spiritually speaking, why there's a change in plans that goes on. And it's a big one, because David was heading down a pathway that was going to lead to a life of marriage to Merib. And suddenly, unexpectedly, plans change, and not righteously. It's an unrighteous change on Saul's part. Once promised, he was righteously responsible to give that daughter to David in marriage. But instead of being married to Merib, David ends up being married to the second daughter, Michal. What's going on there? What are we meant to catch from that part of the story? Anyone? All right, that the bigger issue here, as I was saying earlier, is the Lord is not just at work in our hearts. He's at work in our circumstances. The Lord doesn't want David married to Merib. The Lord wants David married to Michal. So the Lord arranges it, even by influencing the heart of a wicked king who is now out of fellowship with God. God moves upon Saul's heart to cause him to change his mind and to break his promise to David, because God doesn't want David married to Merab. We're going to see, we're not there yet, but later on in the story of David's life, there's going to be a very dramatic circumstance that develops in which David ends up having to order the death of five of Merab's sons. There's a connection there that's not supposed to happen, because the Lord has other plans for her and her descendants. But David has a date with destiny, so to speak, in that he is supposed to be married to Michal. Now, one of the things I draw from that is that David has his own desires here. Even though he gave an initial reluctant response, he was ready, willing, and was taking steps to be married to Merab. Those represent David's desires. Saul has his own desires, and they're in the desires of a scheme to eliminate David. And yet the Lord changes, using Saul's own evil perspectives, he causes him to shift and change his mind. And God is at work in David, God is at work in Saul, but above and beyond their hearts, he's at work in the circumstances. And he causes all things to end up where they should end up for David. And David ends up being married to the person he's supposed to be married to. Even though he didn't plan it that way, even though Saul didn't plan it that way, even though Merab didn't plan it that way, God had a plan for who David was to spend the rest of his life with and who he was to be married to. So the story unfolds, as we see in verse 20. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. Now one of the details that is missing from the earlier description of the possibility of marriage to Merab rather than to Michal is we don't have any mention in the text of where Merab's heart was in relationship to David. Doesn't mention anywhere that Merab loved David. Now, of course, she would have married him, because in those days, a daughter married whoever the father told her to marry. It wasn't an argument. There wasn't any options. If the father said, I want you to marry this man, that's who the daughter would marry. Merab would have married him, but it would have been a loveless marriage. Here, Michael's heart is already stirred toward David, and we see in that the hand of the Lord's blessing for David's life, in that the Lord had prepared a woman to share David's life, and she loves him by the hand of the Lord. The Lord has stirred that within her heart. That's another evidence of the Lord's blessing on David's life. So the servants of Saul tell Saul about Michael's love for David. The word gets out, and the thing was agreeable to Saul. Now, what's meant by that is, it's not like Saul hears the story from his servants. Hey, Saul, did you know that your daughter, Michal, really loves David? And his heart is warmed by that. And he thinks to himself, you know what? I'm so glad that my daughter has found the man that is meant to, you know, fill her life as husband. And I want my daughter to be happy. I want her to be blessed. I want her life to be fulfilled. So I want to arrange for my daughter's marriage to Michal. It's not like that. And what we see from what unfolds immediately is that Saul is just as bad of a father as he was a king. Saul was a wicked king. And Saul's a wicked father. As he hears the report of his own daughter's love for David, what is his next thought that follows that? How can I use this information to further my own evil plan to eliminate David from my life? And so he cooks up a second plot that's very similar to the first plot that he had going with Merab. And that is, he says to David, or he thinks to himself even before he says it to David, I will give her to him that she may become a snare to him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. In what way is Saul conceiving that Michal might become a snare to David? What's he thinking there? He's thinking that she's going to be the bait in a trap. That's what snare means. I'm going to set a trap for David, and I'm going to use her as the bait to lure him into the trap. She's attractive. She loves David. David's going to desire her and want to be with her. And so I will use his natural motivations to get him where I want him, where he will be vulnerable to the hand of the Philistines. And now he's going to add some additional responsibility here toward the Philistines that's going to, in his mind, ensure that this time he's going to get David and he's going to eliminate him as a problem. So David has as the servants of Saul under the direction of Saul go and communicate this second offer to David. And it's interesting that the second time Saul sends his servants, the first time Saul just went and talked to David face to face and offered Merib to him. The second time he doesn't go and talk to him directly. He sends his servants to make the offer of Michal. Why do you suppose he sends the servants the second time? Yeah, exactly. He's lost the trustworthiness in David's eyes because, you know, he went and offered face to face and then later pulled that offer off of the table in an unrighteous way and changed the whole scenario. Now he's scheming to bring David back into this scenario by the soft and smooth words of his servants. That's the whole idea of go and tell him these things in secret. And so the servants go and tell David, and David has a similar kind of response to the second offer. He doesn't say, what really strikes me about David's response in verse 21, it says, but David said, is it a trivial thing in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, talking to the servants, since I'm a poor man and lightly esteemed? It's interesting that David doesn't respond with, no way am I accepting this offer. I'm not even considering it. The last time he offered a daughter to me, well, look what happened. You think I'm trusting this guy? He doesn't insult Saul. He doesn't react to Saul's previous unrighteousness. He responds in an almost identical note of true spiritual humility. He still views Saul with honor, even though Saul doesn't deserve by his actions or by his character any honor from David. Nevertheless, and this is a note that's going to carry through continuing problems with Saul. Saul continues to hate and treat David like an enemy, and David continues to honor Saul right up until the moment of Saul's death, and even honors him beyond his death, even though Saul doesn't deserve it. And this element of David's character, I think, is something very near and dear to the Lord's heart, and it's something we can all gain some perspective from and apply in various circumstances of our life. My guess is, for every person here, for every man here, no matter how young you are, we've all been in situations already in our life where someone didn't treat us the way they should have. Someone mistreated us, someone insulted us, someone had a bad attitude toward us, someone didn't, you know, do for us what they should have done for us or what they even promised to do for us. How should we respond in that circumstance? You know, the kingdom principle is not, you know, do unto others as they deserve to have done to them, is it? Do unto others as their attitude deserves. Do unto others as their behavior deserves. What's the kingdom principle? Absolutely. Do unto others as you would have them to do unto you. In other words, treat other people with your attitude. Treat other people with your words. Treat other people even in your private thoughts the way you would want to be treated by them, whether they ever treat you that way or not. You walk in honor toward other people even when other people are dishonoring you. And if you will do that, the Lord will cover you. He'll watch over you. He'll protect you. He'll vindicate you in the long run, like he vindicated David in the long run. He will make sure you're not ultimately taken advantage of, even though in treating them better than they deserve, you might be taken advantage of in the short term. Just like Saul took advantage of David by pulling back Merib when she should have been his wife and being given a replacement. But the Lord covered it because the replacement was better than what he lost. What the Lord gave him for honoring was better than what he lost in the process of honoring. And so David has that good, healthy, honoring, humble response. And yet Saul's not dissuaded. He wants to carry out his scheme. He wants to accomplish what's in his heart to accomplish toward David. So he says to David, the king does not desire any dowry except 100 foreskins. Because one of the things that David had protested is, you know, I'm not a rich man. I can't afford to be the king's son-in-law. In those days, it was common. We've kind of lost this practice. I think it's a good practice. It would be one for us to be, it would be wise and healthy for us to reinstitute something similar to this in our social patterns. But it's been lost, and that is that when a young man would be engaged, betrothed to marry a young woman, at the point of the betrothal, it was appropriate for the young man to give a bride's gift to the bride's father. So David knows that. He understands that that's what's normally expected. And the more rich or the more powerful the father of the bride, the larger the gift would have to be for it to be an appropriate gift for that father. And so what do you give a king who has everything as a gift? And David recognizes, I don't have anything of value that I can give to him. And Saul knows that that's going to be a barrier to his own scheme being carried out, and so he concocts a plan. David, I'm not asking anything of value from you. I don't want any money. I don't want any dowry of any kind. All I want is for you to do me one simple task. That simple task is, I want you to go and I want you to bring me back 100 Philistine foreskins. Now, why would Saul be thinking about foreskins in a situation like this? What's he after here? Why wouldn't he just say, I want you to go and kill 100 Philistines and bring me back their 100 swords to prove that you actually killed them? Because the foreskins represent proof. But why foreskins as opposed to their swords or their shields or some piece of their armor to prove that you've actually killed them? What's going on with the foreskins? The Israelites were covenant people. The Philistines were outside of God's covenant. The Israelites were circumcised. The Philistines were uncircumcised. And the idea of cutting off their foreskins is like an image of forcible religious conversion. Okay? But these men are dead. So what's the point? The point is that this was a beautifully devious plot on Saul's part. If David were to kill the Philistines, the rest of the Philistines that are left alive would have a certain kind of reaction and response to David, which is, look, this guy killed Goliath, and now he's killed 100 of us. We need to take care of this problem that continues to present itself against our nation. But when David, after these men are dead, mutilates them by cutting off their foreskins, which is a symbol that, you know, Israel is basically spitting on the Philistine nation, it would make David most hated among the Philistines, enrage the leaders of the Philistines to a point where we're not going to stop until we see this man David dead. He killed our champion, and now he's mutilating our best soldiers. We've got to get rid of this problem. Saul's kind of conceptualized all this in his evil scheming. And my guess is that he probably had some demonic inspiration in coming up with this particular plot. And so he's sure that if I can get him to just accept this challenge, whether he actually kills those 100 successfully without dying or not, it's going to ensure his death, because the rest of the Philistines' leaders won't stop until he dies. So how does David respond? Does he say to himself, anticipating the problems this is going to create, oh, you know, my king, that's way too much to ask. There's no way that I could possibly meet that particular bride price. What's David's response in the circumstance? He's somewhat upbeat about the whole situation. He's like, is that all you're asking? 100 foreskins? I got that covered. And he goes out with his men and does what? Kills 200. He doubles the bride price. What I'm reminded of here is the statement by the Lord Jesus that if a man compels you to go 1 mile with him, what are the disciples of the Lord supposed to do? Go 2 miles with him. Double the requirement. You know, use the challenge as an opportunity to show that you're trusting in the Lord in this circumstance. And so David's trust in the Lord is revealed by him not just embracing the hatred that will come to him from 100 Philistine mutilations, but he says, I'll double that. I'll make myself, if this is what the king wants, I'll make myself doubly hated and despised by the Philistines, and I'll trust the Lord in that, and I'm not worry about myself. I'll trust that if I'm doing the right thing in the eyes of the Lord will cover me. So he goes out, he kills the 200 Philistines, he mutilates them, he brings the foreskins back to Saul. And what's Saul's response at this point? Verse 28, when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus Saul was David's enemy continually. The idea is that David successfully defeated the 200 Philistines and comes back essentially without a scratch on him. It's clear now in Saul's eyes, I can't fight this guy, but I hate his guts because he represents everything I can no longer be. And I will always be his enemy. But I, you know, it's like this boiling frustration in Saul because he can't actually accomplish the evil purposes in his heart against David. And then, verse 30, what's the result in the wider circumstances? Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle. Now, why are they going out to battle all of a sudden? This is in response to David's 200 mutilations. It does serve a purpose. And Saul's idea is, I'll stir up the Philistines against him. And it did accomplish that. But it didn't result in the end of the plan the way Saul had planned it. So what we see here is the hand of the Lord in the wicked plan of Saul to stir up the Philistines, but it's for a different end result. And what is the different end result? Philistines just stirred up to go out to battle for their defeat, not for David's defeat. In other words, the Lord has something that he wants to accomplish in the midst of the Philistines. And God is going to use Saul's plan and David's willingness to go out and meet the Philistines in battle, because as it goes on to say, then David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul. The idea is behaved himself in battle against these Philistines because he's one of the military leaders. And the blessing of the Lord is evidently on David, even in the midst of this escalating warfare against the Philistines. And what's the Lord eventually working to accomplish? Well, we'll see later, just fast forwarding in the story by way of a quick preview. There's a plan of the Lord to eventually make David the king of Israel in place of Saul. And when he does, the Lord is going to change the relationship between Israel and the Philistine nation, and he's going to change it permanently. Up until this point in history, the Philistines were continually at war and at odds with Israel, and they troubled Israel all through the reign of Saul because Saul was disobedient to the Lord. By the time David, who is obedient to the Lord and under the Lord's blessing, gets into power as king, the Philistine problem is going to be forever removed from the scenario. And this is the beginning of what the Lord has planned long range. So God is at work even in the wicked plan of Saul to accomplish a greater kingdom purpose of defeating the enemies of the Lord, who are represented here by the nation of the Philistines. Those that were, remember, worshipers of the false god Dagon, for instance, and refused to acknowledge the presence and the reality of the Lord. And so the Lord is at work even through this circumstance to accomplish his greater plan through the life of David. So, what is the big lesson we're meant to take from this? That God is at work in your heart to accomplish his purposes in changing you and transforming you more and more to be like his son. But he's also daily, continuously, in unseen ways, and only occasionally will we see and glimpse and understand exactly what he's doing, but he's at daily and at work in your circumstances around you. And he's shaping and designing the circumstances to cause even greater growth in you and to set you in circumstances that will result in the fulfillment of his greater plan for your life, why you're here in this world to begin with. And that we need to trust the Lord even in the midst of suddenly changing circumstances, like an offer of Mira being taken off the table and a replacement being made at the last minute. Those kinds of things are all serving the Lord's purpose in our lives. We need to learn to recognize the hand of the Lord, not just in us, but the hand of the Lord at work around us for his purpose. All right, we'll stop there and we'll pick up next time, Lord willing, in David's life in chapter 19 of 1 Samuel.